Five fresh decisions from the United States Supreme Court. We'll talk about one or more of them on this week's Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza and Tim Donner.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
Hey, a president! Can you believe it?
I love the poorly educated.
The voters have guaranteed themselves slavery, economic disaster.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
I have never met with Russians.
Our elected representatives can abuse subordinates and then secretly use a slush fund of our money to pay them off.
Black Lives Matter, the Antifa movement, is interested in preserving the fabric of America.
This is The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com. Tim Donner and Scott Cosenza coming at you double barrel this week. And Scott, it was a busy week for the Supremes, and we don't mean Diana Ross and the people that accompany her.
Sadly, no. That would be a better week, I think. No, the Supreme Court, well, so let's get the big case was the case that NCAA had sued to enforce a federal law against New Jersey that would prohibit them from getting casino sports betting in casinos. That had been stricken down by the Supreme Court in a decision that opens up, Tim, countrywide, any state now can get a sports book. And right now, Las Vegas is the only state in the country where they have sports betting. I was out there, 2 months ago, and for my first visit, and I was surprised to learn how much of the economy, for instance. So I was there, a week before March Madness was going to right. get involved, and they were primed, man. There are, elements of that economy were functioning almost exclusively on waiting for that March Madness to come, and the river of money that was going to come in and be bet there. So they also, in that decision, there was kind of a fight.
Just to interject for a second, yeah, I mean, when you go to Las Vegas for the first time or you go to a major casino where there's a lot of sports gambling, you're really struck by what the size and magnitude of the operation, entire massive rooms with scoreboards basically running up and down, changing constantly with the odds. So it strikes you when you see it at a place like Bellagio or Caesars, the degree to which there's sports gambling. Because if you think about it, you usually think about, well, you're going to go, everybody's playing craps, or they're playing roulette, or they're playing the video poker game, or whatever it might be. Or if you really want to lose big, baccarat. But anyway, continue with the sports betting line.
Yeah, those big boards are. It's not a small investment. It's not like some little guy with a chalkboard putting numbers up on
not
a board.
Exactly.
With
all the guys who are going to be put out of business now because of the Supreme yeah. Court decision.
Exactly. A wire room is what they call it.
Right.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court, what I was going to say is that there was also a little bit, for those of us that are super into the finer points, Justice Thomas and Justice Ginsburg went back and forth a little bit on this commandeering principle. Anyway, I think that it's a huge decision for the country. When Congress passed the law initially that was just now declared unconstitutional because it commandeered state legislators, they just wanted to stop sports gambling. They were being pressured by the NCAA and the NFL. All the sports leagues don't like the gambling because, Tim, if they can't make money off of it, then they don't want people making money off of their sport, for sure.
It also does compromise the product. I mean, if there's massive amounts of gambling surrounding the sport,
yeah.
it creates questions like the scandal in the NBA.
Sure.
With referees in the NBA.
I'll tell you this, though. So you're right. Well, listen, the gambling pressure will corrupt the sport. It already has in basketball. We know it has in baseball. We know it has in college ball. We can presume it has in everything. Hockey. I mean, anytime there's an advantage to be made, I think that people are going to seek that advantage illicitly as well as within the confines of the law. But what's more likely to catch when one of those things happens? I think if there's open reporting of the action on a given side, right? So I think the big casinos talk to each other. You know, if they've got, like, you know, a ton of action on one side of a bet, or they see odd plays involved, they do adjust their odds accordingly. I happen to – there's actually – I don't even know if it's still on because I haven't listened in a long time, but there used to be produced – I bet the archives are out there – by ESPN, a cool podcast called Behind the Bets. And the guy who hosted it was he would have these professional gamblers on. You know, these are the guys who are really behind the scenes. And they would go in with massive amounts of money. You know, they have they actually have the capability to move a line both with the amount that they're betting and just the knowledge that because the casino, the bookmakers, they know that those they're called sharp money, right? Where's the sharp money?
You can see that, by the way, at and you and I have done them together, the dog races and horse racing, of course, too. But particularly at a small track like the one we went to in Florida, you can see where there's very little betting on a race, and the odds are changing. And then all of a sudden, a couple minutes before the race, you see the odds change dramatically on a given dog because somebody's put down 200, 300, 500 bucks automatically changes the odds dramatically. But what we're talking about are just really changes around the margin in terms of the lines on these games, right?
The point I would say is that the argument that there is nefarious or untoward activity surrounding sports when you allow gambling, I would just say, well, that's going to exist whether you allow the gambling or not. You have a better chance, I think, of discovering it, maybe not at the time, but perhaps afterwards, and investigating it if it's actually legal, for the most part. I just think that sunlight is in all respects, a better deal for society, and that's what we can have here. You know, with this law. And really, it's almost hard to underestimate the amount of crime that goes along with.
Right.
This is the bread and butter of organized crime.
Absolutely.
Taking illegal bets is the lifeblood of, I mean, they must be going nuts right now, Tim, to figure out what are they going to do. This is more than putting away the heads of the five families. You want to stake a knife through the heart of organized crime. You legalize drugs and gambling? I mean, you've just knocked them out of at the knees.
I mean, the argument is really in a way, Scott, right at the sort of the same level when you're talking about drugs, which is that if you make it illegal, that's not going to stop it. It just means you cannot measure it and you cannot control it in any way. Whereas if it is legal, it's bringing them inside the tent where if somebody has a drug problem, you can be aware of it and control it or try to deal with it. Same with gambling. I mean, if it's legal, then there's more above board than below board.
You could almost forgive the first drug prohibitionists, and if drugs got more expensive and harder to get and usage rates went down, then you might have a colorable case that the harsh measures taken are worth it. And I think I still would disagree, but fortunately I don't even have to muster that argument because it never happened. And I don't think that this has helped with respect to gambling. And the other thing, Tim, is all those people that you know and I know, and I happen to be, I don't not do it because it's illegal, it's just not something I really do, is I don't bet on sports, but I know dozens of people that are like pillars of the community types that do presumably no crimes at all, with the exception of probably violating a posted speed limit now and again, who do, they have a bookie, whether it's an online thing in the Caribbean that they use illegally in violation of federal, a dozen federal laws and state laws, or a guy at the corner bar, or a friend of a friend they know, or as is, I just think, a staple in the Northeast, especially the office betting pool. It's as common as can be, and it's all illegal because of these prohibitionists. So I think, the fact that lots of people don't have to be criminals going forward, I think, is a great thing and a great benefit to society, those people and us, and it just becomes a it's like an excuse for the state to harass people they don't like, if they're engaged in illegal gambling.
Now, in some sense, really, Well, in a clear sense, but in a sense that people don't usually think of the issue of federalism. But this does strengthen the 10th Amendment, does it not? It strengthens federalism, which has been taking a beating, let's be honest. The 10th Amendment's been taking a beating for so long now, for this entire century and going back further, where it was becoming more and more of a dead letter. But it is ascending again, the significance of the 10th Amendment. And this is one small, or maybe bigger than small, piece of it. Yes.
That's a fair reading, I think, Tim. And I would say that while the sort of medium term view or such of the sort of 10th Amendment jurisprudence is right that it's taking a beating. In recent times, I think that it's on the upswing. The sort of coalition now with Gorsuch on the court, that's good news for. I have not seen anything come out of him that I didn't think was very good. I think that if I live to be 100, I'll be thinking that the best thing that came out of the Trump presidency was Justice Gorsuch at the present time. Now he's still got time to break my heart. perhaps he will, but for now, yes. And so I agree, and I think that's very good.
Now, there's also, as we move on to another case here, there's also we hear a lot about the First Amendment, of course. The Second Amendment's been in the news constantly. The Fourth Amendment is a major problem. So that's been discussed as well. But we don't hear a lot about the Sixth Amendment, but that is a critical part of the McCoy versus Louisiana case. Tell us what happened in that and how the court ruled.
Mr. McCoy killed his son and his wife's parents. Not sure exactly what set him off against them, but in any case, that's what he was convicted of, and he got three death sentences for each of those murders. And the problem was that at trial, he wanted to argue that instead of not being able to be convicted because he didn't have the requisite mindset or intent, okay, he was checked out mentally, insanity defense, if you will. He didn't want to put forth a insanity defense. He wanted to argue that there was some grand conspiracy involving police and others and that he was out of state, blah, 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 which nobody believed but him, including his attorney. And his attorney basically said, I'm trying to keep you off of death row here. We got to give the jury something to, you know, understand that while you did this, you weren't guilty of first-degree murder, and therefore you don't deserve to be put to death. Well, Mr. McCoy did not agree with his counsel's instructions, and he said, no, we're going with the conspiracy defense. The lawyer, with permission from the trial judge, did not obey the wishes of his client and argued both in the case in chief that Mr. McCoy committed the killings, but that he wasn't guilty of first-degree murder because of this diminished or mental capacity that he didn't have. And then also, again, at the sentencing phase, after he was convicted of the murders, again, didn't work. He got three death penalty convictions. He appealed those convictions and said, you know, that wasn't okay. I should be able to direct this part of my defense. It's not some minor part of my defense. And the Supreme Court agreed 6-3 that he's right, and he is getting a new trial. Now, the three that disagreed, Alito wrote the dissent, and Thomas and Gorsuch joined in. And Thomas and Gorsuch, more so than Alito, generally are a little more protective of people's rights. I think Alito is more deferential to the state, and so he's not at all a favorite of mine. And Thomas and Gorsuch are, so I was a little bit like, what's their thing? And they just say that they didn't actually admit to the crime. They admitted to an element of the crime. That's what the counsel did. And to say that admitting to a certain element of the crime, barring any other facts, alone grants you a new trial, creates a new right that doesn't exist in the Constitution. And they did go on to say that, you know, nobody's arguing that this was a miscarriage of justice, okay? Mr. McCoy does not suggest that he didn't, you know, that there wasn't a lot of evidence presented, sufficient quantity of evidence presented that a reasonable juror could find beyond a reasonable doubt that he murdered those three people. So their position is nuanced. It's the first I've considered it, actually, when I read the their decisions. This is not an issue that I had seen many briefs on or anything, so I don't know how I feel about their contention, but I do have to say that I'm reflexively sympathetic to it, to a judgment or you know, something that Thomas or Gorsuch would say. So I'm going to take a deeper look at it as time goes on and see what I think about it. But for now, I have to say, if I was the defendant, I think that the defendant should be able to control these things, even if he is, you know, what other people would describe as, you know, unhinged or not sophisticated or whatever the way to say it is.
I don't see where there's much of a question about that. I mean, a counsel is basically hired or assigned to a defendant. The defendant has to make the decision ultimately about how they want to plead, right? And in what way and for what reason. I don't understand how a counsel could possibly overrule.
So this is highly technical. Uh-huh. So you used a technical word there. For instance, how they would plead. They do control how they plead. This isn't that. And so the analysis, if you would go through it at a sort of micro level, there would be certain decisions, like the decision of how to enter a plea, for instance, that would be solely in the hands of the defendant. But so the argument in this case is that this decision does not fall within that major level because the evidence, again, was so overwhelming. So, yeah, I don't think your criticism is – that's what I thought when I first read it. I thought, how is it even possible? You know, and then I read the dissent, and it didn't sway me, but it wasn't ridiculous either, I would say.
I think it's encouraging, to me at least, you know, looking for some bright spots in a court that has become increasingly partisan, that the two decisions we've discussed already, and we're going to talk about a couple other ones, that you have the justices split different ways because you're not talking about bitterly partisan issues like Obamacare. So there's no ideological agenda really at play in terms of gambling or in terms of the rights of a defendant. And it's kind of refreshing to see a decision that you feel is probably straight up and not colored by partisan beliefs. Or am I being gauzy pie in the sky?
You know, I saw the there's a documentary called The Notorious RBG. It's about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and how she's this icon to this millennial feminist group of people. And, you know, I don't understand what the worship there is about. I really don't get it.
She's on their side. What more do you need to know?
I guess. I don't think her writings are particularly, or her speech is particularly, I mean, she's obviously not an idiot. She's on the Supreme Court. I'm sure that she deserves to be there, not just because of her sex, although that was probably why she was chosen, but I'm sure her intellect and acumen is equal to the men that she sits on the court with. But I don't, when I read her writings, I don't think, wow, that's formidable. That's something very special that future generations will be looking at, you know? So with that in mind, a couple of the Ruth Bader Ginsburg decisions that the court made, you know, it's just so it, she voted against the there was an argument between her and Clarence Thomas in the sports betting case, Tim, where she wanted to carve out the section of the law that was unconstitutional, that the majority said was unconstitutional, and keep the rest. There's all kinds of other restrictions in there about lotteries and all sorts of other stuff. And the majority held that no, this entire legislation, this act is tossed out. Congress can go back to the well if they want to and pass a constitutional law, presumably, right? But my thought when I read it was like, she just can't have, you know, less government, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, and she, and the argument was that, and Clarence Thomas, he just did a great kind of, a great breakdown. This is why, now he's a guy, okay, I'm not going to get a tattoo of Clarence Thomas on my shoulder, but I would, okay?
But were you to get a tattoo,
yeah, exactly,
it might be
of justice.
Him. Yes.
He wrote a great, an eloquent defense of a jurisprudence that if one element of legislation is stricken down, that you need to toss the whole thing. And the reason why, Tim, is if you can imagine, if you and I were fighting about some detailed piece of legislation, Who knows later on in court which of those details, if it were omitted from that legislation, would cause us to vote against its passage rather than for its passage. Right. So once you take out any material provision of that legislation, the view there is, well, we don't know if it would have passed.
It clouds the vote.
Yeah. And guess what? Do we have a legislature that sits once every 25 years? No, we don't. We have a legislature that sits perpetually. So if the law is stricken down and a new law needs to be passed jiffy quick, well, then they can go pass a new law jiffy quick.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that one form of legislating from the bench by saying, well, there's parts of this law that are fine and parts that aren't, and that is not the job of the Supreme Court or any other judge.
It's exactly legislating from the bench, and that's what Clarence Thomas opposes, and sadly, it seems to be very comfortable for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she probably would call it something else rather than legislating from the bench. So I want to be fair to whatever her argument would be, but I believe that that's what it is, and I think that judges should stay away from it. There's plenty enough for them to do with the narrow job that they've been given. That's hard enough.
I would say regarding Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I have not seen her speak. I have seen some other Supreme Court justices speak. However, my father, who's a rock rib conservative, and he was one of the earliest members of the board and major funder of National Review, so he's got basically unimpeachable credentials as a conservative, he saw her speak, and he said she was very impressive, which, you know, he's no lefty. So that was actually pretty interesting to me.
Will he be getting a Ruth Bader Ginsburg tattoo upon his person, like these young ladies?
He's 91 years old. I'm not sure the skin could take it. As a matter of fact, I think a lot of people, you want a good investment in future years, tattoo removal. Are going to be rethinking those decisions of youth.
I think you just cover up the Ruth with the Clarence. I think that's a move. Yeah.
There you go. There's a good compromise. Yeah. So now that you
that'll be a documentary for somebody making that transition.
Now that you've shattered my illusions of a partisan free court making decisions free and clear of their own personal opinions, you've shot that one down. So let's move on to a couple other cases. Okay, there's United States versus Sanchez.
Yeah,
Gomez. It involves wiretaps and.
Let's just fast forward. There's one other case that I think is kind of more important to talk about.
Okay.
And with time, I think we could just do that. Bird, that's the Bird case. Yeah.
Okay. Bird versus United States.
Yeah, and Terrence Bird. Basically, he's a drug dealer, okay, or drug transporter, and he got a girl to rent a car and give him the keys so that he could then transport a mess of heroin across the state of Pennsylvania. A Pennsylvania state trooper profiled him because he was driving a rental car, presumably because he was black too, although that's not a part of the record, but we just assume that, and pulled him over, and he wasn't listed on the rental agreement. So it says quite clearly on the rental agreement, the only people who are allowed to drive this car is Jane Doe, who actually did rent the car, and anybody else must be listed. Nobody else was listed, right?
Yeah, whoever obeys that.
I know, right? Maybe for cross-country travel it's important, but, you know, if you go down to the 7-Eleven, I'm sure that people are just like, oh, go take the rental car,
yeah,
right?
Of course.
I've done it more times than I can think of, probably, but on the side of the, okay, you back the car out of the driveway, and when I signed the rental agreement, and the guy who was not a part of the rental agreement, and somebody said, here, take the keys and move the car around the block or whatever. So it is very common. Well, the Pennsylvania State Police said because he was not on the rental agreement, that they could treat it like it was a stolen car. Like he had literally no rights to object to a search. And if you think about the crazy legal gymnastics that requires, Tim, that means that if he was at a roadside rest stop and you went into the trunk of his car, that he couldn't call the police and say, this guy's in my car, because he doesn't have a legal right to it. It's just, it seems nuts to me. And so many of these infringements on our civil liberties come in service to this drug war where they just ratchet down and attack at all fronts our freedom. And this is another one that could have gone in a bad way. Now, we're lucky that the Supreme Court disagreed, Tim, unanimously so. And I want to say that the Obama Justice Department and the Trump Justice Department were putting forth this argument. That
well, there you
not
go, the
on
spirit
the,
of bipartisanship.
Yes. There's Dave Smith, the podcaster always says that anytime they say it's like a bipartisan thing, like, you got to double down on your vigilance because you know that it really gets coming down the pike here, right, when they agree on it, you know. So I think this is a good decision. We'll see. Yeah, unfortunately for Mr. Byrd, he's probably still going to have to go to prison because there's a few more bites at the apple that his prosecution can take. But he won this battle. He had, I think, 50 bricks or 50 kilos of heroin in the car, and he seems to be have a number of rookie moves. He had like a provisional license and like a rinky-dink outstanding warrant from New Jersey. Drug couriers out there, you know, if you're going to have that much heroin, you want to make sure that your license is in order, that you've settled your traffic warrants and minor disputes so that you can go unbidden.
On this issue of partisan versus bipartisan, I think a lot of people think that every issue that comes before the Supreme Court, there's a bitter partisan divide, that leftists always vote one way, constitutionalists vote another way.
Right.
But in fact, the great bulk of decisions are really don't involve issues that are hot politically.
Yeah, they're not right? terribly contentious. They're sort of workaday housekeeping matters of the courts. You remember that there's just a lot of business that goes before these courts, and there's a lot of housekeeping matters that just have to reach the Supreme Court to be settled, just because they're the ultimate arbiters of it.
How many, I mean, roughly, I didn't need an exact percentage, but what percentage of cases that go to the Supreme Court are ruled on unanimously one way or another?
I don't have an answer for you.
Is it a majority, you know, of them, would you say?
I think that, for, like most people, I pay attention to the sexy ones, right, you know. So the ones that are, like, we have this case that came down, which was the United States v. Sanchez Gomez, and it has to do with how prisoners are shackled before hearings. And this was unanimously ruled to be a moot case, but it just seems relatively unimportant. There was no ruling issued. You just kind of move along. It doesn't have precedential value. It's sort of a no big deal. I would say that most of the cases, the majority, are like that in their being not sexy, not front page. Now, how many of those get a unanimous verdict? I don't want to speculate too much.
But a lot of 7-2s, 8-1s, 6-3s.
Oh, and a lot of per curiam decisions, which are, they're not only just unanimous, but no individual justice even authors them. It's like, you know, the court just issues a ruling. No, yes. There's a lot of those.
In other words, it
well.
Isn't even contentious enough for an opinion to be justified. It's just a straightforward ruling. Okay, thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
At Liberty Nation, we never stop trying to make things more convenient for our busy audience. That's why we've developed a new, faster, and more intuitive app. Simply download the LibertyNation.com app from Apple iTunes or the Google Play Store. Liberty Nation stays on top of the latest news and developments, and now you can too. I'm Tim Donner, and this is The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com.